Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, with the best stories of the week from daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Amina Shakir, coming to you from Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Walkley Foundation. And today on the show...
Half dozen years, that as you approach full-time hours in the gig economy, your wage falls below the minimum wage.
Australia moves to introduce minimum wage and protection for gig drivers.
And it's a community problem, so it needs community solutions to address it.
Community groups boost support during UN campaign against gender-based violence. And later today...
We've got social media. We've had 2 years of the pandemic, which I think has impacted the social fabric of our society.
Report reveals a rising burnout and tougher conditions for Australia's school principals. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Delivery drivers for Uber Eats and DoorDash are likely to soon have minimum wage, following a decent deal struck with the Transport Workers Union. The deal has been submitted to the Fair Work Commission and, if approved, will come into effect between July 2026 and January 2027. In a world first, Australian workers will have a minimum safety net wage of $31.30 an hour and be granted other protections such as accident insurance, new dispute resolution processes, and representation rights. The Wire's George Popel spoke with Michael Kane, the national security of the Transport Workers Union, about the struggle gig economy workers have faced over the last decade.
It's a critical moment in time for workers in the gig economy for years now, since the gig economy entered Australia back in 2011, 2012. Workers in the gig economy have been deliberately placed outside of the protections that we've built up for decades in Australia for employees. Companies came in, engaged workers as independent contractors, and therefore workers didn't get things like the minimum wage, leave entitlement, the right to workers' compensation to help them back to work when they're injured. These are things that workers just didn't have access to as independent contractors. So what we're talking about here is for the first time ensuring that every worker for every hour that they work on an app will never receive less than these rates for that period of time. And that just hasn't been the case. In fact, we know from surveys that have been done over the last half dozen years that as you approach full-time hours in the gig economy, your wage falls below the minimum wage.
While the deal has been widely celebrated, one criticism is that the minimum wage will not cover periods of time spent waiting between jobs, meaning that in quiet periods it is possible for drivers to make less than the proposed minimum wage.
There are times, of course, in the gig economy, as there were for taxis and still are for taxis, where there are quiet periods. That hasn't been chomped off on this occasion, but for to say this, that this is not just a minimum wage proposal. This is a minimum wage plus 25% proposal. So we're getting to a point where we're starting to think about how do we make sure that people are able to recover some of their costs for doing the work? How are we able to make sure that they're getting some recompense in addition to the minimum wage for periods of time where there isn't work available? The consistent view of workers in the gig economy is that they do appreciate the capacity to be able to jump in and out of work when it suits them. So we think this system gets the balance right. We can always do more, but this is a massive uplift in the capacity of workers to understand what they're receiving and to be looked after when they're injured and to have a minimum pay for all of the work that they perform.
There is also concern that a minimum wage will increase prices for consumers of DoorDash and Uber Eats.
We don't think that prices should increase. Of course, it's absolutely true to say that digital labour platforms have, in a sense, got away with paying workers well below what they should have been paid for a very long period of time. And, of course, that money, rather than being in the pockets of workers, has found its way into the bottom line of these digital labour platforms. So from a moral standpoint, you would be hoping that the platforms are going to put their hands in their own pockets here and not ratchet up prices. But if we're to take a reality pill about it and say, well, platforms might put up prices a little bit, I think we have to ask ourselves as a community, what's our tolerance for that? Certainly, we've become very accustomed to the convenience of gig worker services. And if you ask anyone whether they enjoy the convenience of clicking on the app and then as if by magic there's a knock at the door and the food's there, I think most people would say yes. But I also think that as considerate and generous as Australians are, if you said to them, look, if you had to pay just a little bit more to ensure that when you answer that knock at the door, the worker has an appropriate wage, they're looked after when they're injured, they have full transparency about their work, I think most Australians would say yes to that as well.
Dr. Caleb Goods is an associate professor at the University of Western Australia. His research is on workers of the gig economy. While he welcomes these changes, he urges the Australian government to improve standards for workers of other sectors of the gig economy outside of food delivery drivers.
You know, people performing work in, you know, the care sector for NDIS, disability support workers, you know, those sorts of workers. A lot of them do find work through platforms in the gig form. There's no applications before the Fair Work Commission at the moment for those workers. I think the regulation is very narrow. We need to move beyond thinking of gig workers just people delivering food and parcels and driving people around in cars. It exists in other parts and some of the fastest growing is in that care sector. So how do we ensure minimum standards and good practices in other parts of the gig economy is, I think, the big question for the federal government.
Assistant Professor of the University of Western Australia, Dr. Caleb Goods Thurman, speaking with The Wire's George Popel. We are in the middle of the United Nations 16 Days of Activism Against Gender-Based Violence, which runs until Human Rights Day on December 10th. Across the country, community groups are now stepping up to offer their financial and social support for affected families. The Australian branch of Rotary International, one of the largest non-profit service charities, has been rolling out programs for decades and continuing to develop new ways to help out.
So we've looked at what's happening in one state and just the tip of the iceberg of what people escaping domestic and family violence have to face. It's also clear there is a need for the community to help in addressing the increasing need for support instead of just relying on government services. It also isn't just happening in South Australia. Across the country, community groups are now stepping up to offer their financial and social support for affected families. For example, the Australian branch of Rotary International, one of the largest non-profit service charities, has been rolling out programs for decades and is continuing to develop new ways to help out.
My name is Christine Owen. I'm a past district governor of Rotary District 9685. I live on the Central Coast and I'm currently chair of the District 9685 Respectful Relationships Committee, which is to do with domestic violence and the approach that we're taking here.
A push from the neighbouring coastal New South Wales district to take a stand against domestic and family violence has spread to the entire oceanic region. It has seen the linking together of grassroots organisations with state authorities and the upskilling of community members to take an active role in supporting victims.
One organisation can't do it by itself. This is bigger than just one organisation. And it's a community problem, so it needs community solutions to address it. Now, different types of domestic violence might need different ways of approaching them. And one of the ways that we partner there is we partner with domestic violence organisations that have mostly in their efforts through their caseworkers working with people who have come to them as a result of domestic violence. It's all confidential. None of the names of the people who are involved are ever divulged to anybody. So it's a way to keep these people safe when they're at their most vulnerable. The Safe Hands Bursaries, we've operated that for this year during the 2025 school year, and we're hoping to be able to fund more bursaries next year. But the funding comes from donations, from Rotary clubs, from individuals, and from others who have a desire to actually assist us to do this work.
What's the reaction been to these programs? What's the community responding with?
Look, the reaction has been fantastic. We've raised considerable amount of money. Everything that Rotary does has to be done, you know, through donations or through grants that we have to match. The DV organisations are absolutely delighted because in lots of cases they run on the smell of an oily rag. So they actually are very grateful for the support that we've been able to provide some of their clients. Some of the feedback that I've got is you can't believe how excited they are about their children being able to have school uniforms or have the equipment that they need to have for school.
You mentioned planning walks to raise awareness. How effective have you found that?
Well, we've had a bit of pushback at various times from people saying, well, what exactly around your question, what does it do? What's it for? Well, we've found it does a couple of things. One, it shows that we are standing up against domestic violence. Secondly, that we're joining with other groups that also are also of the same opinion. This is councils, DV organisations, other groups that have an interest in this. And over the few years that we've been doing these walks, we've had quite a number of people feeling that Rotarians are reputable people and that they can come up to us and feel quite comfortable in divulging that they are victims of domestic violence. And from there, even though we are not the experts in this, and I can't emphasise that enough, we're not the experts, but we can refer them to people who are expert in this field.
You've listed a lot of programs and a lot of different approaches to this. What do you think success would look like?
Success would be if we didn't have to do any of this, if there was no domestic violence, that people treated each other with respect and dignity, with kindness, and there was no need for any of this to happen. That's a long way off, I think.
NRN's political reporter Noah Saccombe there with the story. A new report from Monash University shows the confronting experiences of public schools principals in their jobs across Australia. Principals have reported negative impact on their well-being and they face escalating psychosocial risks such as burnout and emotional exhaustion. 4EB's Eduardo Jordan spoke with Professor Jane Wilkinson from Monash University.
So it was Monash University in collaboration with Deakin University and the University of Sydney. We were the lead institution. And what we did was we sent out a survey to Australian principals nationwide through their union newsletters and principal associations. And we asked them to comment on, report back on a critical incident that they had experienced as a principal in the last 5 years of being a principal, how they had reacted professionally, but also how it made them feel at a personal level, and any messages or responses that they would like to give back around the critical incident itself. We also did interviews with about 28 stakeholders to get an idea of the sort of bigger challenges and issues facing the emotional loads, putting the emotional loads on public school principals.
Now, the research also shows school principals have negative impacts such as stress, trauma, PTSD, etc. What are some of the reasons principals have these issues so far?
It's a great question. So it's important to say at the start that principals and public school principals are very committed to their job and they get an enormous amount of satisfaction out of it. The reason that they talked about the physical and mental health impacts around the emotional management aspects of the job is for a variety of factors. We're certainly seeing that society is more complex, it's more challenging. We've got social media. We've had 2 years of the pandemic, which I think has impacted the social fabric of our society. Some of the other factors that I think are impacting on public school principals are that in Australia we have a very inequitable funding regime. So something like 2/3 of children go to a public school, but public schools overwhelmingly educate the vast majority of the most disadvantaged children in our society. So that gives the emotional labour, the emotional management demands on the principal, a particular kind of public school principal, a particular kind of intensity and edge.
Now, you earlier mentioned emotional labor. Just for our audience mm-hmm. who's unfamiliar with it, what's emotional yeah. labor and why is emotional labor absent from policy frameworks and role descriptions, according to the report?
So emotional labor is a wonderful term that was coined by a feminist sociologist, Arlie Hochschild, in the 1980s. And she actually did research with air hostesses. What she commented on was that they're being paid a wage to look a particular way and to behave in a particular way, including using their emotions in certain kinds of ways. And what she meant by that is if, for example, the air hostess is dealing with an upset passenger or, you know, someone who's very aggressive, you know, they can't actually show how they might be feeling on the inside. So you might, as a human being, as an air hostess, be feeling really upset inside or angry, but you can't show that. You've got to keep that professional mask and smile and be pleasant. If you think about education and being a principal, it's a caring professional profession and it's a deeply relational profession. However, what education departments typically are focused on, because of the competition, if you like, in the OECD in particular, with PISA tests and NAPLAN scores and all that sort of thing, it's become an incredibly competitive performance where schools and school systems are being asked to perform academically. But what that does is it put all the pressure, if you like, and the description of the principles becomes captured in making sure that academic performance is occurring, making sure that the governance of the school is occurring. All of these things are very important, but it leaves out the emotional aspects and the caring aspects and the relational aspects of being a principal.
That was Professor Jane Wilkinson from Monash University speaking to 4EB's Eduardo Jordan. New South Wales government reforms are being introduced to allow GPs management and diagnosis of ADHD. Patients are expected to save between $500 to $1,400 each year, with even greater savings for families with multiple members living with ADHD. With more than 560 GPs already trained as continuation prescribers, thousands of patients have quickly benefited from easier access to prescriptions and ongoing care. I spoke with Dr. Rebecca Hoffman, GP and Chair of RAC GP, for more.
Yeah, so what we're seeing for our patients is two things. Is for those that already have diagnoses and are already on their usual stable medication, they no longer need to wait or travel to see a pediatrician or a psychiatrist. They can see their usual GP to get their usual medication. So what that means is that, as with ADHD, sometimes things are forgotten or misplaced. So if you have forgotten your medication, if you're unable to source it because of the shortages we have with long-acting medication, or if you've just put it somewhere and can't quite remember, instead of having to rush and call and beg to see your pediatrician or psychiatrist, you can actually see your normal GP, same as you would for any other medication, and they can write that prescription for you. But as important is for the patients that I saw yesterday, that are looking at a new diagnosis. And so for them, that means that already there's no longer a 12-month wait to see a psychiatrist, because I can tell them that they can expect to be seen this side of Christmas. So it really has shortened the timeframes to get in for new diagnoses by ensuring that GPs can do the continuation prescribing instead.
Why is it important for doctors to be trained in diagnosing and prescribing for ADHD medication?
Yeah, so the key is around access. At a conference I was recently at, they said that 80% of ADHD can be managed in primary care in general practice, and 20% of it really needs to remain the role of a non-GP. And that's where we would like to see it sit eventually, is we'd like to really see ADHD is the same as so many other chronic diseases that we manage as GPs, is that we can do the vast majority of it. We can manage our patients who are stable. We can manage the diagnosis and the initiation of patients who don't have multiple other complex diagnoses as well. But for those that do, for those that might have a few other things going on, might also have autism or additional complex care or additional complex needs, then we need to make sure that that 20% are able to access our non-GP psychiatrists and paediatricians as quickly as possible, that they're not waiting 12 to 18 months to get their initial script and diagnosis.
You mentioned it'll be life-changing for patients. What improvements have you seen with families so far since GPs were allowed to continue ADHD prescriptions?
Yeah, so my patient I was talking to this morning who came to the press release, she was saying when they last did the Premier's reading challenge, she wasn't able to read. She was in year three and getting through just one book was a challenge. But this year, so less than 2 years later, she's been medicated and she's already finished her 100 books. She's absolutely flown through it. She's not only learned to read, but she now loves it. She embraces it. This is what's life-changing about prescribing someone with ADHD medication. It's not a fix-all. It's not a one-stop shop, but it means that she can then engage in OT and in therapy and engage in school and learn to read and actually see that as something that's enjoyable.
That was Dr. Rebecca Hoffman, GP and Chair of RACGP, speaking to The Wire. In late 2024, Australia's Human Rights Commission released a national anti-racism plan with 63 recommendations. A year later, civil groups say the federal government hasn't acted, and over 50 organisations are urging it to fund and implement the plan now. Radio Adelaide's Emma Watsky spoke with Adama Kamara, Deputy CEO of Refugee Council of Australia, for more.
I think that the joint statement that we released was over 60 organisations have signed on to it. And it's really what we're clearly saying is that, one, we commend the government for showing leadership in commissioning the framework to be drafted, but the leadership has stopped in just the drafting of the statement. We want them to continue to the next phase in acknowledging it, but also funding it for implementation. Racism is something that the communities we work with experience every day. It's a significant impact on their lives, and we just want the government to show leadership by funding it.
I understand there were 63 recommendations in the commission. What do you want to see most implemented from the roadmap in order to address racism in Australia?
So the first recommendation is that the government should acknowledge that the framework has been developed and respond to it formally. And the second recommendation is actually funding a task force. So the task force would be responsible for overseeing the implementation of the framework. And those two points are the main two. I think once those two are actually actioned, then the rest of the other actions can be implemented.
And the Australian Human Rights Commission created the framework following community and sector consultations over several years. Why do you think that community consultation was so invaluable in constructing the framework? And what were some of perhaps your objectives or your organisation's objectives in the community consultation process?
The first part is about giving people the opportunity to share the testimony, the experience of what it was like experiencing racism, and also what to contribute to what action needs to happen for change to occur. So I think it's giving the power to the community to say, tell us how you experience racism, but also tell us what you think needs to happen for racism to be addressed in Australia. We took part in that. We involved refugee and asylum seeking communities in that because we've seen repeatedly how it impacts their sense of belonging and their ability to fully settle in Australia. So it was really important that the community consultation was so extensive. Without consultation, I don't think the framework would be as strong as what it is now, because it actually responds to real life situations that communities across Australia have said they experience when it comes to racism.
The commission heard that First Nations and other negatively racialized people, that systemic and structural racism is deeply embedded throughout Australia. What has been the impacts of systemic racism, and what structural reforms are necessary, or what would they look like, in your opinion?
I think our main work as Refugee Council is working with refugees and people seeking asylum. And what we hear clearly is, as newcomers to Australia, it's obvious to us that the way Australia is set up has not been set up for the First Nations peoples. You can see the barriers in access to education and even the outcomes. You can see barriers to employment. In all aspects of life, you can see how the systems that have been set up are negatively impacting First Nations people. And it's really clear from the consultations that we had, if that is not addressed, newcomers newcomers like us will also be part of that system. Addressing racism is not only going to have better outcomes for First Nations, but also newcomers like us from refugee and asylum seeking backgrounds in Australia.
On that note, what impacts has racism or racist behaviour or language had on people who are needing to resettle in the country and create community and sense of belonging in a new place, especially if they are refugees?
So one of the things we hear all the time from refugee communities is that whilst, you know, their journey to Australia has not been an easy one, they've faced significant challenges and threat to life. Arriving in Australia, they felt they were going to be safe, you know, chance to start a new life, rebuild what everything that they've lost. But one of the hindrances to that new life is actually how they've been treated because of their race and that intersection of race and refugee status as well. That's actually hindered their ability to feel like they belong to Australia. We've had people who'd say, look, if I'd known it was going to be like this, I wouldn't have come. I thought I would be safe in Australia, but I don't feel safe. I don't feel like I belong. I don't even feel comfortable to go outside or engage in day-to-day activities like joining a sports club because of the racism I experience there, or go shopping because of the abuse they receive or suspicion that they're going to steal something and so on. What we're hearing really strongly is that people don't feel safe coming to Australia in day-to-day activities, in addition to the systemic challenges they experience.
And what's it like for you to hear those sorts of impacts?
I feel as a nation we can do better. We can do better because we have put our hand up to say, yep, we are party to the Refugee Convention. We've made a commitment to protect people who are in need of safety, in need of protection. Yet after arrival, they're not getting that protection. They might be safe in a sense of, you know, there might not be that physical harm, but that psychological harm that comes with racism is just as damaging. So it makes me angry that we as a country are not treating people with respect and dignity and discrimination still exists.
That was CEO of Refugee Council of Australia, Adama Kamara, speaking to Emma Watsky. And that's the end of today's show. Thanks so much for your company. The Wire Weekly is a collaboration between radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio 4EB in Brisbane, and contributors from stations across the country. With the great support from the Walkley Foundation and the Community Radio Network. We'll see you next time with the stories making headline across your community and Indigenous radio. At the same time on your local station. Check out all of our week's stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on social media. Just search The Wire Radio, all one word, on X or on Facebook and Instagram at thewire-independentcurrentaffairs on radio around Australia. The Wire acknowledges the Wurundjeri Wurrung people of the Kulin Nations, the traditional custodians of the land where this program is produced. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging. Today, The Wire Weekly is brought to you by Radio 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. I'm Amina Shakoud. Thanks so much for listening, and we'll see you next time with more stories on The Wire Weekly.